Hello, welcome to the For the Love of Weather podcast. This is the podcast where we discuss the Earth's atmosphere and how the weather and climate impact our daily lives. Hi, I'm Gemma.
Hi, and my name's Aisling.
We are here at the Royal Meteorological Society's first ever Weather and Climate Conference at Reading University. We're having a great, great time. We're going to be talking to lots of guests over the next few days, and we're going to bring you some of those interesting and insightful conversations that we have. We hope you enjoy.
We are with Amanda Makeup from the University of Leeds. We always start by asking our guests, where was your first spark of joy? And you thought to yourself, I'm going to do something with the weather.
I think probably for me, it came a bit later in life than perhaps some of your guests might have had. So when I was a child, I was very interested in the environment, but my real passion was about animals. And I actually thought I'd always grow up to be a vet. And then as a teenager, I kind of rethought things. I was taking my physics lessons at school, and I got very interested in physics, and particularly astrophysics. And my physics teacher sort of said, I think you think naturally like a physicist. So that's what inspired me to go to university and ultimately study physics rather than becoming a vet. But I'd always had an interest in the environment and so on. And then when I was at university, I was studying at University of Manchester, and during that time they merged with another university who had an abstract physics group, and it was at that time that I was able to take courses in atmospheric science for the first time in my final year of my degree, and I just realized I was really interested in applying physics to understand the atmosphere. I liked that it was more applied, it was more something visible to me that I could understand going outside every day and just looking up at the skies and thinking about, you know, atmospheric motions and clouds and all of these things, whereas some of the other areas of physics seemed a bit more remote to me and a bit more theoretical. So it probably wasn't until I was almost finishing my degree that I thought maybe this is a way for me to bring together my interests in the environment and my interests in physics together.
So your current job title is Professor of Dynamic Meteorology, is that right?
It's Professor of Climate Dynamics.
Professor of Climate Dynamics. You must have had quite a journey to get there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got from A to that?
Yeah, I think it's worth starting out with the fact that I don't come from a family of academics. I come from a family who do other things. They weren't kind of scientists naturally, so it wasn't kind of ingrained in me that that was even a career path that I might take. And I think looking back now, I just see that I sometimes wonder how I ended up becoming an academic in the way that I am today, because I just sort of went through step by step, I guess. After university and discovering my passion for atmospheric science, I went to study for a master's degree, which I enjoyed, and then I stayed on to do a PhD because I found research really interesting and I like to discover new things. And after that, I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? I've got my PhD. I'll stay on and as a postdoc and do some research for a few years as a postdoc. And eventually, I guess I found my ambition that I was going to try and pursue this in the way of becoming an academic, because I like research and I enjoy teaching as well in the university. I enjoy educating our students about the topic. So for me, that kind of combined both worlds. But it really wasn't an ambition that I set out to do. And I think it's really important to kind of make that, you know, aware to people that, you know, this is something that you can pursue. I came from a very normal background in Coventry. I grew up in a very average place on an estate in a single parent family with my brother and sister. It wasn't that I was sort of predestined into a world of becoming an academic. It was really just my passion for learning, my passion for education, my passion for science that kind of took me along this route.
As a professor, communicating to your students is so important, but how do you do that in an effective way? Like, it's so hard to communicate, particularly a complicated subject like weather and climate and the atmosphere. How do you actually communicate that and engage them and get them interested in the subject?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in the university, I teach students all the way from the first semester of the first year, coming in to study environmental sciences as a degree, all the way up to teaching our postgraduate taught students who are coming to work on our interdisciplinary climate futures program at Leeds. So I'm teaching the full spectrum of students all the way through their educational journey. And I think I found, you know, for me, try to instill my passion over to other people. So when I'm speaking, I try to convey my enthusiasm, my interest in it, and I try to sort of describe to the students how sort of fundamental and exciting some of the things are that we're learning about. So for example, I teach about the water cycle in the first year to our students, and I talk about how important water is as a substance on the planet. You know, within the context of our climate system, we have clouds in the atmosphere, we have the oceans, we have the cryosphere. You know, water is everywhere, and how fundamental it is, and try to sort of catch them on that enthusiasm, you know, with me, so they relate it to themselves. So I think it's really important that people can try to relate the topics that you're talking about to something that's tractable to them, something that they can sort of see and experience in their everyday lives.
Have you noticed a change in your students over the years? So like social media has blown up the last 10 to 15 years. People don't always watch mainstream television. There's TikTok, there's YouTube, there's AI. Have you noticed students coming through? Is there a change in or a shift in psyche or how they do things? Has anything changed since you started teaching?
I think the big shift to me has been the rapid growth in concern about climate change, you know, in young people. And it's very clear now that, this is a topic that is very high up the agendas of young people today. There's lots of surveys that show that this is, you know, one of the things they think is, you know, the most important issues globally that we need to be trying to deal with as a society. And I think that motivates a lot of people now to want to come into our field, that they feel they, this is an important issue. They feel there's not enough action currently that's being taken to try to, mitigate further climate change, and they want to contribute their efforts and their energy towards something positive, something that they see is going to be positive in the world. And that, to me, I think is a really, really strong driver now that perhaps wasn't the case when I started out my own degree, many years ago now as a physicist. I was interested in physics. I wanted to learn about science, but I didn't necessarily relate it at that time to some of these very current, you know, societal issues that we have. And I think nowadays that's a huge motivator for people to feel that they're, you know, contributing to something that's going to help to change the world in a positive way. And I think that's fantastic. You know, the youth voice around climate change has been so powerful, and it's really had, I think, a very strong effect at the highest levels at you know, the Conference of the Parties meetings within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. We see all these people speaking on the global stage, and their voices are being heard, and I think that's great.
Just to ask you something just about the Royal Meteorological Society. You've worked with them before. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I actually started out I became a member of the Society as a PhD student a long time ago, and at that time became a member of their meetings and events committee as the student representative at that time. And I actually stayed on that committee for a long time, hopefully not overstaying my welcome, but I actually sat on that committee for many years, and that's the group of people within the Society who help to organise the Society's meetings programme, so all of the national meetings that the Society holds, and also liaising with the local centres of the Society and the special interest groups of the Society as well. So we were kind of the committee who oversaw all of that fantastic work that's being done and helped to kind of organise and plan events for people to attend. And in the end, I sat on that committee so long that they eventually made me chair. And so I ended up becoming chair of the committee in 2017 and sat in that role for about 4 years. And through that, also had the opportunity to be part of the Royal Meteorological Society's council and to be part of the sort of higher level management and organisation of the society within the council's work. So, yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity. I really, really enjoyed it. It was brilliant to get to work with a very diverse set of people who were involved in organising and helping to deliver the events, and also just seeing the impact that had. You know, we had hundreds and hundreds of people attending every year the events. There were great shifts over that time towards doing online events. Some of that was pushed through because of the pandemic and the need to kind of do more online. And I think in the end, that's actually had a really great benefit. There's been some fantastic things that have come through, like the masterclass series of the Society and other sort of hybrid events. So, it was fantastic to be part of.
So during your time in academia, have you noticed a change within the gender split? Is there more female professors now? Like, how has that changed over the years?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question. So in my institute, historically, we had we didn't have very good gender balance within the academic staff. So we have quite good gender balance for PhD students, so people coming through getting their doctorates, and also at the postdoctoral level, it's a reasonably even split between male and females at postdoc level. But we then see a drop-off happening when we come to the sort of ongoing tenured academic staff. And I think the barriers there that might, you know, I've just recently stepped down as being head of the Institute for Climate and Atmospheric Science at Leeds after having that role for almost 4 years. And during that time, you know, we were hiring people into academic roles and found that, you know, often we weren't getting applicants, we weren't having female applicants into those roles. And I think there's research that shows there's many barriers that might put women off from applying for those sorts of roles, whether people kind of perceive themselves as being suitably qualified. You know, maybe people look at the criteria and think, well, I don't meet every criterion sort of fully, so I'm not going to apply because I don't think I'm going to be competitive. That can be a big barrier. And what I would say to that is, don't be put off by that at all. You know, talk to people around you, talk to trusted colleagues, get their advice about the career stage that you're at. And if they tell you that you should go for it, you know, take that advice seriously and go for it. Don't be put off at all. I think sometimes people worry about whether they can balance the duties and responsibilities of being in an academic career with other responsibilities they might have outside of work. You know, there's lots of evidence talking about the roles that women may have at home and caring responsibilities for family or for elderly parents and so on, and people can sometimes see that as a barrier. They just don't think they're going to be able to put in the hours, and I think that's a big cultural issue that we have to try and overcome. You know, it should not be the case that people think that they aren't going to be able to have a successful career if they're not able to commit every second of their lives, you know, to their work. It's a job, ultimately. We all have a right to have a life beyond the realms of our work. And that can include family. You know, I have two young children myself. I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. And, you know, my partner works as well, and we kind of juggle it. It's a juggling act, without doubt, but we do manage to juggle it. So, you know, I think that can be a barrier for people. And I would say nowadays there's a lot of positive role models, certainly within my institute, of, you know, female academics who have families and, you know, managing to juggle it. And I think, you know, also once you get to the academic level, there are issues with going more up to more senior levels. So, you know, within my own institute, we had a very poor history of having female professors. We had, in the last 10 years or so, we'd hired quite a lot of early to mid-career female academic staff, but they hadn't reached the professor level. And I'm pleased to say that in the last year, myself and two other colleagues were promoted to professor. And we now have 3 female professors in the institute, which I think is a brilliant step in the right direction. So to academics who might be listening to this, you know, don't be put off from applying for promotion. That's another key thing. You know, I think all of the colleagues that have been female colleagues who were promoted in the last year to professor were told, you know, in the course of that process that they'd waited too long, that they could have been promoted earlier and they'd held off doing it. And I think that's another thing that people would tend to wait until they feel that every criteria that's on the list they can meet and exceed. And, you know, often that's really not needed, and it's not the case. So again, you know, seek advice from, you know, trusted colleagues and mentors, and, you know, put the time in, prioritize yourself and prioritize your own career progression to enable you to do that.
So if you had to give your students one message, what would that one message be? What's one thing that you wish they would take away?
I think it's seeing the benefit of doing foundational science to build up to a point where we can then apply it in order to bring about solutions and benefits to society. And I think nowadays we think a lot about the solutions, we think a lot about the applications, and that's really, really important. But I think as a student in particular, where you're building that kind of foundational base that's going to carry you through your career, it's also worth spending time thinking about, you know, the harder bit sometimes with the kind of core science and getting that underpinning understanding. Because no matter what job you end up going into, if you end up going into policy and you're working in government, you know, you're working in the private sector, in a business, if you've got the ability and the knowledge and the confidence to go in and talk to a room full of high-level people within your organisation about climate change and the reasons that they should prioritise it, it's going to equip you really well if you've got the confidence and the knowledge to talk about some of those key underpinning bits of information, as well as what that then means for them in their organisation. So I think it's that balance of spending time working on the foundational knowledge to put you in a position to be able to then advise and go into different sectors and apply that knowledge to ultimately bring about positive change.
I guess as well, so that they can also speak to people from different disciplines that might know the whole detailed level of it, they can understand where some of the problems might be.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's some of the things we're trying to do now at the University of Leeds, where we're working with this cohort of master students on a very interdisciplinary climate change focus program, where we are trying to convey the foundations of the climate science, but also the social science and political science elements that we need to bring together ultimately to be able to kind of make transformational change in order to tackle climate change and enact solutions towards adaptation and mitigation in the longer run. So it's about having, understanding each of those different areas so that no matter who you're going into a room to talk to, you're confident to be able to communicate with them what the kind of key points are for them and what they need to do about it.
Amanda, that's amazing. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
So our next guest on this mini podcast series is Miles Allen. So Miles, can you explain to us what your job title is? But then also, can you explain to us, when was the first spark of joy when you thought I might work in something to do with weather and climate?
Gosh, well, that was a long time ago. I'm now the head of atmospheric, oceanic and planetary physics in the Department of Physics in University of Oxford. And I'm also a professor in the geography department there because I work on climate and the interface between weather and policy and so on. But most of my work's around climate physics. I've been in physics of climate for quite a long time now. I started thinking about moving into this field when I was working in East Africa after my first degree. I was working in the energy unit of the United Nations Environment Programme, very lucky to have a temporary job there. And my boss at the time, climate was just bubbling up. Jim Hansen had just testified to the Senate to say that the drought they were experiencing and heat wave they were experiencing in North America was the first harbinger. This was in the late 1980s. Dates me a bit, was the first harbinger of climate change, which was controversial at the time. So my boss, Yanis Pastor, who actually went on to advise Ban Ki-moon in the run-up to the Paris Agreement, he told me if I wanted to work in this space, I should go and get a PhD, which is what I did. Came back to Oxford, and to be honest, have barely moved ever since. Certainly not out of the Thames Valley, not very long anyway.
So, hop, skip, and a jump later, you're in attribution studies, which is a relatively recent thing in my memory. So now they're much quicker at being able to, provide an attribution study.
The idea goes back. The original motivation really was back in 2003. My house was nearly flooded. At the time, this is the sort of rather light-hearted origins of this field. We had flooding in Oxford, which we've had a lot for a long time. But we had a 1-in-100-year flood in 2000, and then we had another 1-in-100-year flood 3 years later. And at this point, people were sort of saying, well, wait a minute. But the mantra at that time was still attribution was something we could say about global indicators, long-term trends. Weather and climate were different. We were sort of telling people, no, this is weather. It's not like you can't relate individual weather events to climate change. And at that time, I thought, I published a short, light-hearted commentary saying, well, is that really ever going? Is that always going to be the case? And obviously, the only way you can do it is by associating external drivers like rising greenhouse gas concentrations with changing risks of extreme weather events. So that sort of risk-based, or the changing properties of extreme weather events. And that sort of risk-based approach has been what's allowed us to develop a whole science around understanding how external drivers are affecting extreme weather.
Just going to ask, for anyone that doesn't know what an attribution study is, so if you had to explain it, is it you take an event and you say how likely that is to have happened with climate human-induced climate change and how likely it is to happen in the future?
Well, that's one of the questions you can ask. It's about understanding the drivers, the role of different drivers in the event that's occurred. If it's an attribution statement, you're typically focused on an event that has actually happened, although in fact you can make attribution studies about events that didn't happen. You know, some people say, well, events might have happened but didn't, you know. And actually those events can be quite important, even though they don't happen, because sometimes they're the most potentially harmful events of all. And you're just lucky that they haven't happened yet. And if the risk of something like that is going up rapidly, you need to know, because then you can actually plan against it and adapt in advance, hopefully save lives. So understanding the role of these external drivers in changing risks of extreme weather events is what attribution's really all about. One way you can ask the question is what you just described, you know, how much more likely is what occurred or something as bad as what occurred with human influence compared to without human influence, or in the future, how much, how fast will this risk get worse? Another question you could ask is, how is human influence and climate changing the nature of the event we're seeing? So assuming this event does happen, is it being made worse by human influence and climate? And how fast are we seeing hotter temperatures and so on? So these are two ways of really asking the same question, which is, what are the role of these external drivers in the event that we're, the events that we're seeing?
How important do you think it is for... So you mentioned back in the 1980s where climate change, it wasn't really believed, and it was quite a big thing to come along to Congress and say, oh, yeah. Drought. And actually recently heard something on a little reel where a politician was talking about, you know, carbon emissions only makes up this amount, and we shouldn't matter about that. How important is it, for the public psyche to have attribution studies push forward so they can more quickly remember? Because we kind of have a 24-hour memory, so we're just at the moment remembering this wet, rainy week. But it was 30 degrees last week. So how important do you think attribution studies are going forward?
I think we've discovered that actually being able to say when an event is fresh in people's minds, what the role of human influence, and give a sort of defensible answer to what the role of human influence is in that event, is extremely powerful. It doesn't mean it's all done yet, and that science, and I think nobody would claim that science is all done, but it's clearly... has a big impact on people. And being able to do it within the news cycle is helpful, not necessarily in the 24-hour news cycle, but certainly in the sort of few weeks time frame where people can actually remember the event in question. I mean, the early studies, I mean, one study we did of flooding in the UK in the autumn 2000, we published it in 2011. So, you know, over a decade after the event happened. I mean, it took a long time to do the study, and, you know, this was a first-of-a-kind study and so on. But obviously, by the time that happened, nobody could really remember what had happened 10 years earlier. So obviously, it's really helpful to be able to do it that much faster. And decisions get made by people outside the climate bubble in response to events as they happen. So, you know, if you can get in quickly and say, on the one hand, this is an event that's becoming more likely because of climate change, and how fast is it becoming more likely? On the other hand, actually, this is an event which just you were just unlucky. It's really not being affected by climate change. If you can say that quickly while people are sort of making decisions about rebuilding or making promises that, you know, you often hear politicians promising when an event happens, we're going to rebuild everything back all exactly the way it was before. Sometimes that's a sensible thing to do. Often it's not. And actually, you know, if an event is getting, if the risk of an event happening is getting worse all the time, it may not be a really very good strategy to rebuild straight back. Or at least if you are going to rebuild, you better be planning, you know, a more robust infrastructure in the future. So that's the kind of decision we can inform. Another really important way in which this information can be very useful is for the insurance industry. Because at the moment, what tends to happen is if insurers suspect that climate change is having a bit of a role in events, and an event happens that causes them major losses, they just pull out of the whole area, and they just say, we're not going to insure this class of risks anymore. And that's catastrophic for people. If they can't get insurance, you know, if you can't get flood insurance for your house, you can't sell it. And that becomes a real problem. And so there's a real cost to the economy of insurers pulling out of classes of risk, where when you actually look at the numbers and do the event attribution properly, you work out, you know, the risk of this event is getting worse, but it's getting worse, you know, maybe it's doubling over 20 years or something. That's something an insurer can cope with. They can just increase their premiums gradually over time and keep providing cover. And so I think that's the kind of information we have to be able to give people much more quickly while they're, you know, for the insurance, it's not necessarily instantaneous information, but it's sort of within a year or so, because that's the time frame over which they reevaluate their premiums and make decisions about whether they're going to offer cover. And that's where I think we can really make a difference with this sort of science.
So you just mentioned, you're talking about people's memories. So there's the public, and then you've also sort of mentioned insurance companies as well. How important, maybe you have an opinion on this or maybe you don't, about naming events. So our storm naming system, I know there's always chat about heat wave naming events, and I was watching something on Sting Jets, and obviously that's associated with the great storm, so like that's very fresh in my mind. How has that played a role in how you're able to communicate, do you think?
I think it's a very different question, but the Met Office has established that naming storms is a good idea. People take them more seriously. If they know there's a named storm on the way, it's something that has clearly made a difference to preparedness, and that saved lives. Because if people know what's coming, and if people take steps, you know, generally speaking, the simple steps you can take before an extreme weather event happens are the ones that actually make the most difference on people's survival and on the cost of the event. So in that respect, yes, I think it's clearly, I mean, it's nothing to do with attribution, but it certainly seems to have been a good idea. Naming heat waves, yeah, I mean, perhaps I would be sensible, because again, in many ways, the adaptation steps people can make, like staying indoors, keeping curtains closed, not going jogging in the middle of the day, I mean, these are pretty straightforward things people can do, and people still haven't quite got their minds around. And maybe if we started naming heat waves and making it a bit clearer that we have an event happening, a well-defined event happening, and reassuring people that the event will come to an end as well. That's one thing which I think we don't perhaps do as good enough job at, is you know, forecasting the ends of heat waves so that you can reassure people, look, yeah, this sucks, you're having to stay indoors, but don't worry, you know, next week or relatively soon, you'll be able to walk your dog in the middle of the day again. I think that'll help as well, because, you know, it's, you know, we need the public to get used to living in a changing weather.
So I guess, well, perhaps I didn't make it entirely clear as well, is that, yeah, like, so insurance companies do understand this idea of like a 1 in 100 year event. They don't, it doesn't make it easier for them to understand it. Like, it's a whole other different language with attribution studies. And do you know, like, for your communication of the work that you do,
insurance companies definitely understand risk. I mean, that's their job. What they appear to work, I should phrase my words carefully here, because I don't know what they actually do. But what I do see, because the insurance industry is notoriously opaque in that you can't really tell how they work out their premiums and so on. But what we do see is when events happen, you suddenly hear that a whole bunch of people are no longer being given insurance for flood risk, for example. And then if you actually look at the scientific evidence, you can see the risk of the event that's caused the flooding is going up, but it's going up relatively slowly, you know, doubling every 30, 40 years or whatever. So there's no obvious reason to switch off insurance cover for that class of events this year. It's like, yes, bump up the premiums a bit, fair, but you know, panic and leave doesn't make any sense. And it's that panic and leave that is actually causing, you know, economic harm, because that's when people are left without mortgages and, you know, left unable to sell their homes and so on. And that really has a negative drag on the economy. So that's where I think this work could be at its most useful, is not so much answering the question of, you know, how much has human influence affected the risk of this particular event relative to what would have happened if we just stayed with the climate we had in the 19th century, but how fast is this risk changing? That's a much more practical question And yes, the reason it's changing is because of human influence on climate. So yes, it's an attribution question, but it's a much more present-day attribution question. It's present-day attribution of trends in risk rather than these questions of absolute changes in risk relative to some hypothetical pristine world that, you know, let's face it, we didn't have air conditioning back in the 19th century either. So there's all sorts of things were different. So it's more of a academic question how over very long term risks.
And just finally, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew? It could be about weather, climate, it could be about attribution studies, but if there was one message that you would like everyone to know, what would it be?
Climate change is totally fixable. And for the amount we spent collectively across the world on fossil fuels in 2022, it could have been fixed. We could have captured every single molecule of carbon dioxide those fossil fuels generated and stuck it back underground and still had money left over. So let nobody tell you that this is an inevitable thing that has to keep going.
And next on the podcast is Professor Penny Endersby, Chief Executive from the Met Office. Before we get to know what you're actually going to talk to you about, we always start by asking our guests, when was the first spark of joy that you thought to yourself, I might do something in the weather?
So I'm Penny Endersby, I'm the Chief Executive of the Met Office, and I came into the Met Office as Chief Executive. So the 25 years of my life before that, I was working in defence. And actually, my real deep expertise was as an armour scientist, designing armour for fighting vehicles and blowing things up. That's what I did for the first 10 years of my working career after I did my physics degree. And I've always worked on the balance of physics and engineering. And so, although I've had a lifelong interest in weather and climate and its impact on the environment, and for example, I'd collected 10 years of rain gauge data in my own garden as just an amateur because I'm interested in that sort of thing. Really, it was seeing the chief executive's job advertised was the first time I seriously thought about it as a professional option. And it went from not having thought about it to realising it was the opportunity of a lifetime instantly, because what I do is work in government, turning science into solutions that save lives. And that's what I did all my career in defence. And I absolutely understood from the start that that was what the Met Office could do. I thought it was a fantastic mission, wonderful organisation. And I gave everything to getting the job as well. I really put everything into it because I knew it was an opportunity that wouldn't come again.
You said the Met Office is the type of organisation that you know can save lives. So why do you think that? What is it that they do well?
The breadth of things the Met Office does is just so completely extraordinary, and you could spend the rest of the podcast just on that. So we are, on the one hand, extremely well recognised for being the National Weather Forecasting Agency, and people understand, I think, that your weather warnings come from us, and those in themselves save life, so people aren't in caravans under trees or blown off bridges or swept into the sea because they've heeded warnings. Obviously, we've got a huge climate mission that works in the sort of annual to decadal and all the way out into the hundreds of years into the future. So, you know, people who are designing flood defences for the future are doing that based on the climate impacts that we're projecting. And then there's all the other stuff that people don't know that the Met Office does. I take the big recent space weather event where we all went out and saw the aurora, and I went out and saw the aurora, and it was fabulous. But satellites were being put into safe mode, planes were being routed away from the poles, communication systems, people were being warned that they might not have access to them. So there's a whole raft of keeping the population safe in that space weather activity that most people are oblivious to. Same goes for routing flights in the jet stream, out of turbulence, away from volcanic ash. That's all part of our mission. And then all the different dispersion work we do from pollen to toxic chemicals, is also part of just the Met Office's service to society.
So you're about to do a talk here. Where do you start to try and explain to people exactly what it is you do? How do you manage to condense all of that down?
I'm extremely well practiced in doing that, because every VIP that comes to the Met Office, you just had a quick whiz around our slide. I didn't do the global aspects of our mission, but I could. Today I'm just speaking about something different. I'm talking about the potential of artificial intelligence to revolutionise weather forecasting, which is both an amazing opportunity and a threat for us, because the Met Office is world leading at what we do, and that's built on having a huge supercomputer running a vast physical model. It's a very high barrier to entry, ingesting 200 billion data points a day, sitting on half an exabyte of data that is the climate record that we have to communicate to people. And AI potentially is a faster, cheaper way of getting at some of the same results and maybe even outperforming in some ways. And that's really exciting, and we want to be a part of that journey and get good at it. But we're also aware there's a lot of hype. I just ran you through some of the breadth of what we do. So you might be able to make an AI weather forecast that gives you a really good 3-day forecast. It's not going to give you, as a byproduct, the ability to see where a toxic chemical leak is going to go. Nice. So the physical model brings you a raft of capabilities that the AI model will not. And so picking our way through that hype and seizing the opportunities, but not getting swept away, and making sure that the people who fund us understand that there isn't suddenly a 100,000 times cheap and cheerful version that will mean you can chuck away what you've been doing for 50 years is part of the challenges.
So it's about working alongside AI as well, like incorporating it as much as you can, but also saying to people, like, there's things that you won't be able to do for us, and we still need to have these things in place.
So certainly running those two things in parallel, I think, will be so for the immediate future, and that broadly be the conclusion from my talk, is we will take the best data to help people make better decisions and stay safe and thrive wherever it comes from. But when we use AI, it will be fully tested, it will be fully validated, and we'll know that we can trust it as well as we can trust our conventional methods before we start providing it in an automated way to anyone.
I've seen the AI talk just now, the discussion. It was fascinating. So I'm like baby beginner level, and actually, as Liz Bentley pointed out to me, I already use AI, but I'm not really mindfully aware that I use it, like you auto-generating captions or something like that. That's actually AI. A lot of what you were saying there was about on the panel was them saying, well, it's not all singing or dancing and you have to test everything. But how do you compete with, like, say the medical industry, who have like a lot more money and are probably able to fund AI in a different way? Like, how are you gonna, because the private industry find use for it, they will, you know, how do you do that? How do you manage all of that going forward? It's such a tricky thing.
So the biggest competition is for skills. We are well funded to do science, to move the state of the art of weather forecasting fund forward, and I can choose to put our efforts in, and we're actually just doing quite a big rebalancing exercise in the Met Office and our scientific programs to give us, and we'll have to stop doing some stuff because no one's going to give me twice as much money, to deprioritize some of our conventional methods, but not stop, because we absolutely still need those to enable us to invest more effort in AI. Where we do struggle to compete, and actually all national Met services are the same because governments never pay top dollar, is on skills, and we have a huge amount of effort to grow our own, to work with universities. We're working with the Turing Institute to exchange with our international partners to make sure that we have a pipeline of skilled AI practitioners building up and staying with us.
So do you see this literally as just the beginning of AI? So I'm assuming in your own way you're forecasting AI definitely being a part of forecasting in the future. It's just the context is
so
still
so yes and yes. Yes, I see it as just the beginning, and yes, I see it being a part of forecasting in the future. There was a bit of discussion of the hype cycle in the workshop you were just in, and that some areas have already hit that slough of despond where it doesn't quite measure up. And I think we do not yet know how much we will end up using our conventional methods, maybe not so operationally, to build us more training data and AI as our operational techniques, versus how AI will be something we add on to the fringes, but the core still is by the conventional physics methods. We just don't know. I don't know anyone who's prepared to really make a firm bet on either side. I just have to ride both horses for the moment and keep our options open.
You do make a really interesting point, though, just something I hadn't quite considered, because AI is just thrown around like it's a perfect solution. But actually, it's not. It's very easy to say, oh, we can just use AI for that, but actually how and when you use it is an entirely different thing.
Well, and the reason that AI has made such phenomenal progress in weather forecasting is because it's being trained on 50 years of numerical modelling reanalysis data. So it's quite quickly caught up with the state of the art. It's not at all clear that it can advance much further without the building or standing on the shoulders of that numerical prediction giant. We just don't know.
Who do you see as the leaders in that at the moment?
So it started off being hyperscalers who have access to all the compute. So the first real weather modeling breakthroughs were from Pangu, Google, DeepMind, Graphcast. But it has been surprisingly easy to catch up. So ECMWF have done an absolutely splendid job with their AI forecasting system. And I'll be talking about the Met Office's global model forecasting system, which we have not yet published. So I think it'll probably be the first time we lift a bit of the lid on that today. And again, it's a question of, is having huge amounts of money and huge amounts of GPUs balanced off by the domain expertise and sitting on all the data that everyone needs to train? Don't know yet, nor do I know how much we want to be in competition versus in collaboration.
And just finally, what's one thing that you wish everybody knew? It can be about AI, it can be about the Met Office, or it can be about weather and climate in general. If you had one message, what would it be, everyone?
The weather you're experiencing today is not the weather all over the country and all over the world. And your lived experience can be valid, but that doesn't mean that climate change isn't happening, because it's a cold, miserable, wet day in Reading today in July.
Thank you so much. We really hope that you've enjoyed this series of mini podcasts from the Royal Met Society's Weather and Climate Conference. We've had a really great few days here. If you would like to follow along from some of the stuff that we've been putting together here, you can follow along on our Instagram. That's at For the Love of Weather. On X, formerly Twitter, it's the number for Love of Weather. And you can find loads of information as well on the Royal Meteorological Society's website and all their social media feeds. We would love it if you would subscribe, rate and review the podcast and share it with lots of people. And as always, we just hope that you leave this episode loving the weather just that little bit more.
Thanks for listening. Bye. Yeah.